It's hard to believe. It's about 44 years today. 44 years today that this country was turned upside down. I was 13 years old when we heard things like this.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Put me on, Phil. Put me on.
Something was terribly wrong. What happened? A number of theories over the years. Have we really gotten to the bottom of it? I don't think so. Broadcaster, author, Fox News contributor, and soon-to-be documentary producer, John Ziegler was not even born when this happened, but he jumped into this subject as a newsman for what reasons, John?
Well, George, I became obsessed with this at a very young age. I was probably a teenager when I decided that, wow, this is the biggest thing that's happened in a generation. I want to know everything there is to know about it. And it certainly seemed as if there was a lot more to the story than the official version that we were getting from the Warren Commission and from our government. And I was a true blue conspiracy theorist for several years. I would say up until about 25, 26, I was right there with the core coast-to-coast audience in believing that there's absolutely a massive conspiracy here. I believed largely in the mob theory because I thought that they had the motive and the opportunity to do it, and I thought that Lee Harvey Oswald had a lot of mob connections. But as I learned more and more, and as I got deeper and deeper into it, and I've read everything, viewed everything I can possibly view and read on this subject and done a lot of thinking about it, interviewed a lot of people about this, I came to the conclusion that the government got it wrong in the specifics, but they got it right in the larger picture, which is that, believe it or not, Lee Harvey Oswald was the guy who killed John F. Kennedy. Now, I believe he did it in a way slightly differently than the Warren Commission suggests, and I've written about this in an editorial at johnziegler.com, which people can see, and I urge them to read it at johnziegler.com, because it's the only theory, I believe, that is consistent with every piece of evidence that we know of with regard to the assassination. And while it's very enticing to believe in a massive conspiracy, I don't think there's any real evidence of one here. Or at the very least, there's not a theory of conspiracy that is not directly contradicted by something that we know for sure. There's a roadblock at the end of almost every major conspiracy theory. And that's one of the many reasons why I decided to go from being a conspiracy guy on the Kennedy assassination to one that believes that the Warren Commission got it wrong in many ways, but right in their target, which was that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Was there an episode that immediately got you to switch, or was it just over time?
Well, I will say that the main reason why I switched was I read a book. Didn't write the book. I read a book by the name of Case Closed, which was appropriately titled, by Gerald Posner. Now, Gerald Posner has done the most exhaustive research there is on this subject. The book is like 700 pages long. I read it in a day and a half, and I'm a slow reader, George, and I'm not that bright.
You didn't go to Evelyn Woods.
No, but I was so enthralled with this, but I believe that Posner got it wrong in the logistics of this. And I've actually spoken to Posner numerous times about my theory on the logistics, and he believes that I may very well be right. There's nothing he knows of that disputes or contradicts my theory on how this actually transpired. And it's really quite fascinating to me as to how many things that we think we understand about the Kennedy assassination are flat out wrong and have led to people coming to conclusions that are not based in fact. I sympathize and understand why people come to the conclusion as A majority of the American people do. A majority of the American people believe that there was a massive conspiracy to kill JFK. I get why people believe that. But a close reading of the facts, I believe, will come to one conclusion and one conclusion only. Lee Harvey Oswald did it. He may have had some help. I actually think that Oliver Stone's movie, as nutty as it was, got some of the specifics right. I think that Oliver Stone was in the wrong church and the right pew, so to speak, because I do believe that Guy Bannister and David Ferry and maybe even Clay Shaw may have urged Lee Harvey Oswald on, and maybe almost as an ego thing, he was trying to impress them. But I do not believe, and that's probably why they were acting so strangely after the assassination, but that when you look at the facts of that day and what we absolutely positively know, there is no doubt in my mind that Lee Harvey Oswald was the shooter. He actually hit on all three of his shots. There was no miss shot, which is what the Warren Commission said. And the single bullet theory, and I understand we're going to talk to Dr. Cyril Weck in a moment, is false. You know, that was come up with by a guy by the name of Arlen Specter, who thankfully we never heard of again. I'm kidding, because he's a U.S. senator to this day. The single bullet theory is complete and total bunk. But where I differ from other theorists is that I believe you don't need the single bullet theory to show that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin.
Okay, I want you to chat with Dr. Weck with me, because you two both agree that that single bullet theory is not alive, not a real one. But you and Cyril differ on so many other things. We'll be back in a moment as we begin our JFK 44th anniversary special on Coast to Coast AM. Look, we're honored tonight to have with us known pathologist Dr. Cyril Weck. He lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He served as the county coroner there, was a past president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and currently directs the Cyril Weck Institute of Forensic Science and Law, founded in 2000 at Duquesne University. Dr. Weck was the founding president of the Coalition on Political Assassinations. That was in 1994, and he has done exhaustive early forensic work on the murder of President Kennedy, and he is with us now. And Cyril, you are friends with a dear friend of mine, Charlie Bosworth, when both of you collaborated to write the book on who killed JonBenet Ramsey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Gee, it's nice to learn of your friendship with Charlie. He's an excellent writer.
Oh, he is.
We haven't been in touch recently, but if you are, please give him my regards.
I will do that. He lives in the St. Louis area, where I go back a lot, and he has tremendous respect for you, Cyril. I used to remember talking with him off-air about just your knowledge and ability, and we're going to bring John Ziegler in here in just a second to chat with you, too. You both have a similar theory on the single bullet. You differ on the rest, but give me your overview, because you believe the Warren Commission is way off-base, don't you?
Let me start off by saying that, you know, I do not believe that there is a massive conspiracy. Mr. Ziegler used that adjective several times. I think that that is definitely not the case. I have no knowledge of who the specific individuals were involved. I have some thoughts as to the political philosophies, ideologies of the people who felt it was necessary for John Kennedy to be removed from office. But I would be willing to bet, if God would come down and give us the answer, that there weren't six people, it could have been three or four, who plotted this, who made the decision to undertake this. Now then, various people were assigned tasks to perform, and certainly some people at some point in time came to understand what it was that they had done, what they were involved in, but I do not believe it was a master conspiracy in the sense that a large number of people made this decision and undertook this coup d'etat.
Dr. Weck, John Ziegler here, I got a question for you.
Yes.
You're the absolute best in the world when it comes to picking apart the single bullet theory. We both agree that that's bunk. For people who don't remember, that's the theory that the second shot fired by Oswald went through Kennedy's back, then his throat, and then went through virtually every portion of John Connolly's body and then came out pristine. My question for you is, if the single bullet theory is not correct, and I believe it's not, you believe it's not, why does that, in your mind, somehow prove that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the assassin? Because I don't think it proves that. Why do you believe that it does?
Well, I was quite fascinated, Mr. Ziegler, by your comments, because heretofore, to my knowledge, and I will leave it to you and to subsequent guests into the morning hours here on the show to get into some of those details, but I have never heard before anybody from any of the earliest defenders, sycophants of the government, and official protectors of the Warren Commission report since 1964 to the present time, and that goes all the way through some people who have been extremely outspoken, some very articulate, some who have written very serious books, like Gerald Posner, and more recently Vincent Bugliosi, whose numbers doubled the Posner's, I think, 1,600 pages and so on. I've never heard anybody dispute the facts as were originally worked out and the temporal sequence that was ascertained by virtue of many things, and some of which have been.
Well, let me throw the theory out at you, and you can tell me. Let me throw the theory out at you. And this is, by the way, a theory that I came up with several years ago. And Mark Furman of O.J. Simpson infamy wrote a book last year that dovetails almost exactly with this theory. Here's what I believe happened. I believe that the first shot was what ended up being what we now think of as the magic bullet. It was lodged in Kennedy's back, fell out in the stretcher that no one knows whether it was Connally's or Kennedy's stretcher. It only went in a couple of inches, and that was the entire first shot. The second shot was the shot that hit Connally, did all that damage, never touched John F. Kennedy, and the third shot blew off Kennedy's head. There was plenty of time, probably around 7 seconds, for those three shots to be fired. There was no missed first shot. The evidence of that, to me, is meager at best. And one of the greatest red herrings of all time is that people actually think that John Kennedy grabbed his throat early on in the Zapruder sequence. He does no such thing. He has his fists clenched. They never come close to his throat. And through it, one of the most amazing coincidences of all time, and it is a coincidence, he happened to have a small hole in his throat that was used as a tracheotomy at Parkland Hospital, therefore rendering it of no evidentiary value, but a hole that was far too small to be an exit wound, did not line up with the hole in the back, could not, as you have said many times, been the exit wound for the single bullet or the pristine bullet. What is wrong with that particular theory? Where's the hole there, Dr. Weck?
Well, what's wrong with it is the hole, to play on your words. What's wrong with it, Mr. Ziegler, is not a matter of what you think or I think. The fact of the matter is that there were some 18 physicians there at Parkland Memorial Hospital, including, of course, the key surgeons. And there has never been, to my knowledge, sounded by what you're saying.
That's not true.
There's never been any question about there having been a perforating wound in the anterior neck midline area at the level of the knot of the thigh.
You're right. But what it was a bone fragment from the shot to the head. There were no metal traces in his tie, no metal traces in his shirt. The reality is the hole was way too small to be an exit wound. You know that. That's why it was used as a tracheotomy.
I must disagree. The head wound would not have led to a fragment. The anatomy is such that the head wound, producing as much damage as it did, would not have produced a piece of bone functioning as a secondary spin-off missile, so to speak. Also, the wound, in addition to its anatomic location and physical inability of a piece of bone to make its way
down. Dr. Weck, do you acknowledge that Kennedy never grabbed his throat?
Well, I can only go by the Zapruder film. I can't.
He never comes close to grabbing his throat.
I would not argue with you that he doesn't. If he doesn't actually touch his throat, I can't see that. but I would disagree when you say that he never came close. As
no.
I don't have it in front of me, of course, but my recollection.
Take a close look at it, Dr. Weck. Not even close.
The hands come up close. Going back to the hole, you have what has been described by trauma surgeons at the Parkland ER as a circular, symmetrical wound. And that, too, belies the theory of a fragment. No reason why it would be so circular and symmetrical. With regard to the size, you're right overall, Mr. Ziegler, when you think of exit wounds as being generally larger. But believe me, it is not at all rare or even infrequent for a variety of reasons for an exit wound to be no larger than an entrance wound. As a matter of fact, if you talk to any experienced forensic pathologist, you pick the person. Don't talk about JFK. Just ask this question. Have you had some cases, sir, in which you've had difficulty where the shot's been fired at some distance so that you do not have tattooing or stippling and therefore no powder burns? Have you had some difficulty sometimes upon first visualization of the body in differentiating between entrance and exit wounds? For one reason, in this particular case, it was partially shored up, so to speak, by Kennedy's collar. A shored-up exit wound can visually mimic an entrance wound.
Dr. Weck, I've got a question I've got to ask you.
2 minutes to go, John.
And that is with the pristine bullet, which you have done a better job of mocking than anybody in the history of this.
And correctly.
Yes, absolutely. The history of this of all these theories surrounding the JFK assassination. To your knowledge, has there ever been extensive DNA testing done on that bullet? Because it is my strong belief that we will find no DNA of John Connolly on that bullet. Has that ever been done? And if not, why not?
That's a good question. To my knowledge, DNA testing has never been done.
Jeez.
We have suggested this many, many times, including some people who are kind of neutral on the issue, like my dear friend and highly respected colleague, Dr. Henry Lee. We've talked about this 1,000 times, and it's quite appropriate for you to ask this question and to join the ranks of those of us who have urged forever and ever that it can't be done.
Why don't they do it, Cyril? Why?
Well, for the listeners, they should know that DNA testing, you know, can be done on objects decades and sometimes even centuries old. So why
don't they do it?
You know, here you and I join ranks in questioning why the government back then did things which were so incorrect and why they have refused to do things now. Here we get into, admittedly, non-forensic scientific theory. I believe, is simply put, that this case is still too hot to handle for the United States government.
I think you are absolutely right, sir.
I used to say when I was younger and maybe more optimistic that, you know, I really, when I was 35, 40, that, you know, we'll see, we'll come to learn the truth. I say now with great unhappiness, great sadness, that it's going to be long after I'm gone. I think it's going to take another generation or two, even for a complete revisiting. All the progeny, the first and second generation of all the people involved will have left this earth before the people in government will feel that nobody's toes are going to be set upon.
See,
nobody's reputations are
absolutely
going to be
right, Cyril. Absolutely right. Cyril Weck, thank you. Noted pathology. You two are very close, John. But
yeah. JohnZiegler.com editorials has all the answers you need. The answer is there. How Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK.
You're not going to change your mind, are you?
Dr. Weck's great, but I'm right on this.
All right. We're going to be back in a moment. We've got more guests tonight throughout the night. John, thank you. We'll be back.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In a moment, a former FBI agent who spent years exhaustively indexing, cataloging, researching all the known evidence of the assassination of President Kennedy. Walt Brown, Ph.D., lives in Liberty, New Jersey. Now he's a former FBI agent spending years indexing, cataloging, researching all the known evidence in the assassination of President Kennedy. His global index to the assassination of JFK is considered to be one of the definitive researchers' tools. And he's also the author of The Warren Omission, People versus Lee Harvey Oswald, Treachery in Dallas, The Guns of Texas Are Upon You, editor for many years of Deep Politics Quarterly, a magazine about the assassination with contributors from the research community, and currently compiling the master chronology, The Death of Our President, November 22nd, 1963, which will run more than 1,000 pages, Dr. Walt Brown. Hello, Walt. Thanks for joining us this Thanksgiving night. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
What was it that got you in this direction to start cataloging and researching this incredible story?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. I worked for the DEA, not the FBI.
Ah, okay. Bio says FBI.
They eventually got sucked into the FBI. And the chronology I'm working on hit page 4,400 today.
Oh, my God. You went over 1,000 by a little bit.
Over 1,000 this time last year and a half ago.
Okay.
What got me involved? I was playing football out in front of my house when Oswald was killed. And the whole family was kind of gathered together because of the tragedy. My father was 40 days older than John Kennedy. And the feeling was, hooray, you know, they killed the little, you know, red rat, kind of. And I said, you know, that's all fine and good, but now we'll never really know.
That's right.
And my father just kept probing me. What is it they're never going to know? And I just kept finding answers for him. And I guess I never stopped looking for, you know, the new twist. And with this chronology, when you line up, well, there's almost 40,000 paragraphs in it. When you line up that many ducks, you know what's wrong with the pond, so to speak.
When Oswald was shot by Ruby in front of national television audience,
right?
Did you say even at that young age, you know what? This is not supposed to happen. This is just too easy.
Oh, absolutely. And I was the only one that's saying it. Everybody else was celebrating. I thought, geez, you know, I must be a little kid because the adults think otherwise.
Nobody thought beyond the obvious. How did he get in there? It was amazing.
Well, what really happened was if you go back and study media accounts, they had convicted Oswald by dinner time of Friday. I mean, he couldn't have gotten a fair trial with the penguins in Antarctica.
No.
Based on what the media said. And it was in a lot of cases, it was just totally factually wrong, but didn't matter. Get it on the air. And that's not the way the media is supposed to work. There's got to be standards for journalism.
I'll always remember that clip, Walt, where he said, Oswald, I'm a patsy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll always remember that.
But what happened? Nobody asked Patsy for whom.
Yeah.
You know, there's obvious questions. They asked him a question about the station wagon because one of the Oswalds that show up in the chronology went and got on a bus, got off the bus, took a cab, and sort of went home back to the boarding house neighborhood. The other Oswald ran down a hill, got in a Rambler station wagon, drove away. And a sheriff's deputy that saw this Rambler event went to the Dallas police headquarters, which is not the same as the sheriff's department, and he said, I got a description of this fellow. And they said, you know, stick your head around the corner. And he said, that's him. And later on they said to him, well, what about the station wagon? And he said, oh, that belongs to Mrs. Payne, where his wife was living. And it wasn't a Rambler. He was referencing a 55 Chevy wagon. And he said, you know, that belongs to her, and she's got nothing to do with this. But nobody said, well, what is this that she has nothing to do with? And they just never asked the right questions.
All your research, Walt, what did it lead you? What road did it take you down?
Well, ultimately, it took me down the road actually two roads. One, that there are tiny little questions that if we could have answers to them, they would just open doors so wide. And secondly, the idea is that it couldn't have happened without at least the knowledge and complicit acceptance. You know, this is not to say, you know, the nine different groups did it, but it could not have happened without the CIA knowing in advance.
As they did about 9/11.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And when push came to shove, the CIA fell on their sword for 9/11. It was either they take the blame or the president, mm-hmm. the coach story, takes the blame. And you know, the CIA, they got a bigger budget, but they fell on, George Tenet fell on the sword. He committed suicide politically to take the heat.
Yeah.
But CIA knew in advance, certainly the FBI knew in advance, and Hoover absolutely wanted to keep his job, which he would have with LBJ. And certainly Johnson had to know in advance.
Hoover hated. You know, we ran a clip of E. Howard Hunt, deathbed confession of a Watergate burglar,
right,
that was recorded by his son, St. John Hunt.
Right.
And Hunt basically implicates LBJ.
Yeah.
Did any of your research lead down that road?
Oh, absolutely. A very good friend of mine, a man who passed away 2 years ago, who needs more credit than you can imagine, named Jay Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
He called me just about 10 or 11 years ago. And because I had indexed what I had done, he calls me and introduces himself, and I quick grab my index off the shelf. And as he's telling me who he is, I look up Jay Harrison. And he appeared in volume 12, page 356 of the Warren volumes. So I just kiddingly said to him, didn't you show up in somewhere in volume 12 in the middle of the 300 somewhere in Don Steele's testimony? He had no way of knowing how I knew. But he just said, boy, you're good. But what you find is what he discovered, he had a conviction that someone named Malcolm Wallace was very much involved in all of this. And in 1984, Billy Saul Estes was granted immunity from prosecution. He would tell everything he knew with respect to his connections to LBJ and whatnot. Mm-hmm. He said, I got immunity. He said, okay, here's the deal. Myself, Johnson, Cliff Carter, and Malcolm Wallace killed 17 people.
17 people?
Yeah. Including...
Over their political career?
Yeah, including George Parr, the guy who made Johnson a senator with the Box 13 scandal, including Billy Saul's accountant and his secretary, who knew more than they should have known about his flim flams, and including John Kennedy. He was one of the 17. And there's some interesting flashbacks to some of that stuff. But Jay Harrison went to the Texas Department of Federal Vital Records, because Malcolm Wallace was allegedly killed in a one-car crash in Texas, and there's a lot of one-car crashes in Texas when you get related to this stuff, on January 7th, 1971. And it takes 25 years to be allowed to get records. So on January 7th, 1996, it was actually the 6th, it was a Friday, Jay Harrison was online and said, I want the guy's records. And I said, well, it's not 25 years till tomorrow, but we're closed tomorrow. It can happen today. And he got everything under the sun, including his fingerprint card from when he was arrested for murder in 1951. Before, and he served 2 days for the murder.
2 days.
2 days. He was convicted. He was found guilty. He was convicted, but the jury was a hung jury, and the one juror that would not vote for any penalty became a federal postmaster by Lyndon Johnson's appointment.
Isn't that interesting?
A year later, yeah. So he gets the fingerprint card, and there was one latent fingerprint found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository that could never be identified.
Don't tell me.
They printed all the police officers that were there. They fingerprinted all 73 employees at a book depository, even though some of the women were never on the sixth floor. the fingerprints that I mentioned.
And it wasn't Oswald's, right?
Nope, because there are no fingerprints of Oswald's on any fixed item. But there was one latent print, and Jay took this latent print to a certified latent print examiner, retired, and the guy studied it, and he said, okay, this fingerprint is that fingerprint. Now, he had no idea whatsoever who he was looking at. Just, this is that.
This is that, right? It's the same person.
Right, and he found like an 11, 12-point match, which is pretty good in court. Well, one match wasn't enough, so they went to a second certified latent print examiner. He found the same thing. He said, yeah, I agree exactly, you know, with what this other fellow found.
Yeah.
And then they said, that's Malcolm Wallace. And all of a sudden, the fella and his wife got skittish and said, let me take another look at that. And he backed away from it.
Oh, he changed his mind?
Yeah, and the next day he returned the check for $500. I have the uncashed check.
God.
I inherited it. And I have the letter from the guy saying, you know, I took another look at that thing, and I just don't agree anymore. But I also have the signed affidavit that he did agree.
Why do we get, Walt, so many different theories of what we all believe?
Well, it's simply because...
And I mean LBJ, the Cubans, the mob, you know, all these different theories of groups that wanted to kill Kennedy.
Well, you know, the shortest distance between two points is something new. You know, part of what you and I are talking about is entertainment, like it or not. You know, to me, it's scholarship, it's research. And I usually put on an enjoyable show when I talk in front of groups. But I don't go there to be entertaining. I go there to be scholarly.
But it's also trying to get back our country that
we lost. Absolutely. And anything, you know, I heard in a commercial before you came on about, you know, we got to name names and point fingers and all of that.
Yep.
A lot of it. I mean, you say to yourself, if you can kill a president in broad daylight in a major American city and get away with it, you can get away with anything. You can invent a war. Well, they did that. You can cover up 3,000 dead people that I can see from my house.
Was it...
9/11.
Wasn't it... God, was it Jack Lemmon who played in that JFK movie?
He played Jack Martin, the investigator.
And didn't somebody say, you know... We can get anybody we want, or something like that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. He tells Jim Garrison, "You are so naive. You know, they could put you away tomorrow." And I happen to think, because that's a common question, I think we're past that point, because I don't think there was not a program on television. You know, and I'm going to use the word yesterday because it's already 3 a.m. here. There was no shows yesterday commemorating the anniversary. It's ancient history. It's like you and I talking about President Buchanan.
See, I don't forget it though, Walt.
No,
I can't.
And I, every day, I had 4 months off this summer from my college teaching. I was 10 miles from my house for a total of 9 hours.
All right, I want you to take us on this ride here in the 5 minutes we have left with you.
Okay.
I want you to tell us what you think happened.
I think you had a number of, and I'll use Jay Harrison's words, pyramids. You know, the military wanted more in Vietnam. The Federal Reserve didn't like the idea that Kennedy was going back to American money and not Federal Reserve money. The CIA didn't like the idea that they were going to be splintered into the winds and, you know, Bobby Kennedy was going to take over the CIA the day after J. Edgar Hoover was forced out of the FBI. The Cubans were going nowhere. They were not going back home.
Right.
You know, deals had been made during the missile crisis. We won't invade. Don't you do anything stupid. And when John Kennedy was killed, an American journalist was sitting with Castro, you know, or a representative. And Castro said, oh, my God, this is horrible. Because, you know, we were about to shake hands again. Now it's 44 years later, and it's uglier than it was then.
Castro wanted Kennedy to stay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He made some noise. Look, if they're going to come after me, we're going to come after them. But that was a bluff. He needed Kennedy. He certainly did. He certainly didn't need Lyndon Johnson. But you've got a whole number of groups that again, as stated in Stone's movie, you know, they're surrounding him. But big oil because of oil depletion, you know, disallowance.
They all wanted him.
Yeah, well, the American people loved him, which was strike two. The power brokers didn't. You know, when the people like you, that's why they passed the 22nd Amendment.
And they knew he was going to get reelected eventually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And not only that, but he was going to be the beginning of a dynasty. You know, Bobby.
Yep.
Teddy.
Yep.
And this was like, we passed the 22nd Amendment to keep this from ever happening.
Oh, yeah, but it's happening now.
We didn't include brothers and siblings.
Yeah.
And then to me, what ultimately happened was, okay, here's the deal. Where is the pressure point? And the pressure point was Lyndon Johnson, because Billy Saul Estes had been convicted in state court and sentenced to 8 years. He'd been convicted in federal court, and he was tied tied like a knot to Lyndon Johnson.
What?
Bobby Baker was on the cover of Life magazine on November 8, 1963, 2 weeks before on a Friday. Scandals. The guy resigned his Senate job that was paying $19,000 a year, and his declared net worth was $1,003,000and $3,587. And I don't know anybody except older, well-to-do retired people whose net worth is 52 times their salary.
And at that time, then, nobody was going to go after a newly, I guess, sworn-in president.
Not even so much that, but the power of the presidency gave him the ability to bury the Billy Saul investigation.
And did he bury all that stuff once he went in?
Sure. I mean, but it all just disappeared. The TFX contracts that were bogus, which tie right to the Texas School Book Depository, it all went up in smoke, because you just get this massive, you get a period of mourning from November 22nd until late August in Atlantic City, when Bobby Kennedy stands on stage there and gets a 27-minute nonstop standing ovation.
Yeah.
And in between, the country is just trying to pull itself together from what happened. And meanwhile, backstage, the Warren Commission wrote a tremendous piece of fiction. It just all got sidetracked.
Do you think Lee Harvey Oswald was involved at all?
Yes.
Okay.
But the thing that I told your producer I was going to talk about was, you know, when you line up 40,000 ducks in paragraph each, you discover that there's two of them.
Two Oswalds.
Yeah.
Is it like?
And I don't ever mean to come on your show and sound like a crackpot, but you got one guy that's absolutely in this place at this time, and you got another guy that's miles away, making himself obvious.
Yeah.
About, I'm a Marine, I'd shoot the president in a second, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
Yep.
You know, and when you come right down to it, if you have any doubt, or anybody calls in your show tomorrow night and says, hey, that guy, you know, two Oswalds, challenge that guy to learn Russian by himself. Because Lee Harvey Oswald was not the most intelligent guy that ever came down the road.
No.
When you read his written work, it's almost unreadable because the spelling's so bad.
It's almost like a grade school kid.
Yeah, he's dyscraphic.
Who was flunking out. Yeah.
Now, you take somebody like that, and you tell me that they're self-taught in Russian? Because I challenged Vincent Bugliosi, who wrote the latest Lone Assassin book. I said, I'll take a year, and I'll learn Russian, and I'll meet you next July on Uspenskaya Street in Sevastopol, and we'll have a chat. And if you can't be there, then you better come out and say, somebody taught someone that they called Lee Oswald Russian.
So when they arrested the Lee Harvey Oswald, he was Marina's husband. He was a patsy.
Yeah.
That guy. And now let me ask you one quick question, Walt, before we've got to go. Is it true that newspapers in Europe printed up the assassination before it happened? Is that true?
No. What was done was that there was material put out following what happened, but the details that were included were premature.
Ah, okay. Thank you. That's Walt Brown. That's one of his theories. We'll have more in a moment.